Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Playing with Fire podcast. Josh and I are content creators for thefabricator.com, and this video interview originally appeared on the blog and their YouTube page. However, we love this interview so much and thought you might also enjoy listening to it as a long-form podcast episode. Yes, we've been on hiatus from this personal podcast space for a while now, but we will continue to pop in every now and then with some solid gold episodes just like this one. Please also check it out with the video on thefabricator.com. So in this episode, we're talking with Anna Waldman Brown, who is a PhD graduate in industrial policy and political economy from MIT's Department of Urban Studies and Planning. She has researched emerging technologies, manufacturing systems, and inclusive job creation with the MIT Work of the Future Task Force. She has worked with international policymakers and grassroots innovators across 60 plus countries to foster creative problem solving and sustainable development. In this interview, we discuss the German versus U.S. systems of welding education, education and employment cultural differences, wage gap versus skills gap, welder pay, automation and AI risk, why we see factory robots up for resale around the U.S., whether or not human life is actually improving alongside technological improvements, ethical economics, manufacturing turnover comparisons, so much more. Anna's work is unbelievably compelling, and it reveals a shared passion for the future American workforce. Josh and I loved this conversation, and we really want to make sure that a lot of people in our industry hear it. It's important, and we think you're going to love it. Welcome, everyone. We're so excited for you to join us for this conversation with Anna Waldman Brown, who is an industrial researcher at MIT. And we connected with Anna. Well, actually, she connected with us after she read Josh's article on the skills gap and his challenge to employers to talk to him about that. Josh got a little bit of backlash from the industry, which we weren't surprised about, but we believe that there's a really important message there. But you had reached out to us because you were studying the adoption of welding robots and SMEs and what's happening to welding jobs in the Midwest compared to Germany. And it is fascinating research, and I know Josh was really honored that you reached out to him. And
I was really honored that you all replied, so thank you.
Mutual honor.
Yeah, exactly. This whole conversation around, you know, welder shortages that we keep hearing repeated over and over, but you are seeing a stark difference in what that means in Germany and what that means in the American Midwest specifically. We've now since read your articles and looked at the research that you're doing based on how the German welders are educated versus how the American welders are educated. But there's so much to unpack here. And so we want to pick your brain a little bit about all of this research. We really want our audience to hear from you directly.
Fabulous. Thanks, Darla. It's a pleasure to be here and have this conversation.
Yeah. So before we jump into all of that, can you share a little bit of your background and how you got involved in this type of research with MIT?
Sure. So I have a background in physics and technology policy, did a little bit of engineering. I have a fake engineering degree in technology policy, have built a couple things, but I'm sure you all are much better at the actual building of stuff. I got excited. So I was working with a group looking at small scale manufacturing in sub-Saharan Africa. And I was particularly interested in energy technologies and what was going on around solar, building solar installations. And so I went, got a fellowship to go do research with a university called Kwame Nkrumah University of Science and Tech in Ghana. My grandmother and my dad had lived in Ghana for a couple years, so I had connections. And then there is some fabulous group called D-Lab at MIT. And it also worked with a group called the Fab Lab Network, which is all about, like, let's democratize the tools of technology production. And so they do more high-end stuff, but I ended up working with a bunch of mostly mechanical engineers there. And it turned out there wasn't really anything interesting happening on the renewable energy front, but the automotive there is these informal clusters of folks by the side of the road who were welding together car parts. And so there are all these small firm networks, people like, you know, 2 to 5 people, maybe 10 at most, in sort of these ramshackle huts that are built out of, you know, the cardboard and corrugated metal that was taken from some abandoned construction site, and they put things together. And in this, you know, it looks kind of like a slum when you get in there, and you realize these guys are building the entire mass transit network for Ghana by hacking together. They get FedEx vans, and they'll build doors, and they'll build seats and put in 15 seats. Huh. And then that becomes a little minibus. And they've started exporting across West Africa. They send to like Nigeria, Mali, Cote d'Ivoire. And they also build all of the trucks which transport the cacao beans, which are exported to make chocolate internationally. And so it's like a hugely important part of the entire Ghanaian economy. But there are all these small scale manufacturers who get pretty much ignored. So I got really interested in particularly metal fabrication by studying these guys and like the folks at the bottom of the supply chain who are really critical for making everything else happen. Came back to MIT to get an actual degree in technology policy. And then a couple years later, with the sort of economic crisis, Trump got elected, MIT started getting both related, mostly related to like the globalization backlash, MIT started getting a lot of flack for what's going on in the US and what's happening with manufacturing jobs here, what's happening around globalization. And they're particularly like, we're building the robots, and are these robots taking everyone's jobs? And so I'd already been working, looking at metal fabrication in Kenya. There was a research team that started up called the Work of the Future in 2008. And so they invited me to come do my PhD with them and continue working on looking at metal fabrication companies, but with more of a focus on high tech and robots and looking at the American Midwest. And so ended up joining that. It's also a lot easier to, you know, go out to Western Massachusetts where there's lots of manufacturing happening. And a lot of automotive too.
Right on.
And so that's how I got involved with this team, which has been fantastic. A couple of them had worked, we're working on the Build Back Better plan right now at the White House, and have been advocating for like domestic manufacturing policies on sort of both sides of the political aisle since like the 70s and 80s. So it's cool to be part of that.
Wow. That's a pretty fascinating background.
I would have never guessed it started with roadside welders in Ghana. Like that's amazing.
I actually did an interview recently with a woman who went over to Ethiopia. She's a welder, but she was basically doing like mission work. But she ran into a group of welders and they were building their own machines and transformers out of cardboard and just corrugated metal parts. And it was a little scary looking. Not OSHA approved.
No, there are definitely some safety issues.
Yeah.
Particularly...
So nice dark pair of sunglasses and good to
go. Yes. Yeah, there's definitely a belief that sunglasses will protect you from arc flash.
Yeah.
Which is problematic.
Yeah, they don't.
No.
Spoiler narrator, they don't.
Yeah, there's actually a colleague at my university in Ghana had done a study on cataracts and other welding related eye disorders across welders. And so there was the push for better safety education.
Is it the education or is the economics of PPE or is it kind of both?
It's definitely both.
Yeah.
I think people don't realize the craziest safety story I heard was from a young woman who had been doing electrical work in automotive repair. And she was sort of an apprentice. Her boss said, you can't do electrical work. And she was thinking of having a baby. Her boss said, look, if you want to get pregnant, you can't go under the car to do electrical work. And I'm not sure, like, there are other ways to jack up the car or do electrical work elsewhere. He convinced her to go into painting. And so then she was pregnant and she was spraying cars
Yeah.
There's like no decent fume hoods or like fume protections.
No.
Luckily, she then went and started her own shop later on that was sort of outside the cluster where she could build a better enclosed area for
like
future.
Out of the frying pan into the fire.
Yeah. Like who says, oh, you want to have a baby? Why don't you just spray toxic chemicals?
Yeah.
And
we got some lead paint in the back. I hear that's even more safe. So
yeah. Yeah. So they have a long way to go. Actually, the sort of sad thing about this cluster now is that they really don't know how to deal with car computers
yeah.
or electric vehicles. Mm. And so there's going to be a big transition point. And hopefully, I mean, this is sort of true, I think, in most countries, developed or not, that there's just a real lack of respect for the people who build the stuff that we need, right? We love the inventors everywhere.
Right.
But
the actual fabricators who are critical to getting anything done are just completely ignored.
Yeah, and a lot of that stems from the people designing things because they think that, you know, well, I have this blueprint here that I made, so, you know, I'm the one behind all this, and right. it's my genius that created this, and you're just a person who knows how to connect point A to point B.
Yeah, but all the fab shops I visited, particularly around Massachusetts, who were, you know, making parts for these MIT startups, right? Actually, one of them's making one of my professor's parts for this crazy new additive like metal manufacturing company. They said no one knows how to design parts for manufacturing. So it's all the fabricators who are redesigning totally. The things. And there's an incredible amount of expertise that goes in, as I'm sure you all know. I was at a talk by Commonwealth Fusion Systems is a new company that's working on hot fusion, and they're also an MIT spinoff. And so, like, this is one of the most exciting things in renewable energy right now, right? They're like building the sun in an enclosed system. And so their first big hurdle was reinventing these materials so they could have these super cooled magnets that could also help contain this superheated plasma. And they invented this brand new material. Everyone was really excited. And then they turned to start building large, you know, their full scale demo out in Massachusetts, and they can't find enough fabricators. And so they're like, the main thing holding us back is skilled welders and skilled machinists who can make this thing and tell us all the ways in which we engineers and physicists are coming up with this wrong, and how is it actually going to get made?
Right on. I have a friend in the automotive industry who I asked him what he thought the future of energy with automotive was going to be. He's like, I think it's going to be reactors, like personal reactors per vehicle. I was like, yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. One of my favorite things about this time right now is material technology is advancing so rapidly. And there's things that, like, right now we could look at and be like, well, that's not possible. But we're also working on the solutions to make those things possible.
Yeah, totally. But unless you have people who know how to build those things,
right?
Like, a society full of inventors is not going to get you anywhere.
Right. And one of the other problems we have right now, especially in the United States with, I mean, which you're keenly aware, which we'll get into, the educational system and how we train fabricators or welders, like, it's kind of hodgepodge and all over the place. So there's not like, you can't just go to someone and be like, well, you have this welding certificate. That means you know how to do all these different things. And it's really, you have to strike it. You kind of have to get lucky and find the right individuals that have maybe the right background that you're looking for, because there is not really a standardized training process in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah, it varies. It's sort of hard. I've been going through my interviews today with different fab shops and small scale manufacturers in Ohio and Massachusetts. And even in Massachusetts, there'll be, you know, out in, you go down to New Bedford, people will say, oh, there's a fantastic vocational high school here, and we can just get guys from there. And then you go like an hour and a half away, and people will say, well, we can't find anybody within like a 20-hour drive of us. There's nobody, you know, right. There are no skilled welders anywhere. And so, yeah, I think it just is so dependent on the region, the connections that you've got. how much people are paying too. I think there's a real, you look at how wages have increased in manufacturing over time and they haven't. So when people say there's like a big skills shortage, what they're really talking about is a willingness to work for, given their current skills, for whatever those wages are.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. As you put so well in your article.
We've already started to jump in a little bit into your research, but let's start with talking about some of what's going on in Germany and what your research has shown while you're talking with these factory owners, operators, factory management, and what that hiring process of welders looks like there. So we'll start with Germany, if that makes sense. So, okay.
Yeah, Germany is actually somewhat easy to explain because it's extremely rigid system where, I mean, there are a lot of things that I don't think could translate outside of the German cultural context. Like you decide in sort of at the end of your middle school, essentially. So you hit eighth grade, ninth grade, I think the ages, yeah, it's like you hit the equivalent of eighth or ninth grade. And you decide immediately which of three different high schools you're going to go to. And so there's the, they weren't started originally in terms of sort of intelligence, but they've sort of become more like that over time. There's the, there's the 2-year high school, which is a full high school. You get a, you know, secondary degree certificate after 2 years. And then you go from there onto vocational training. And your vocational training is a for fabricators specifically, is a 3.5-year apprenticeship program where you will spend half of that time learning welding. You'll learn fabrication. There is a very rigid set of skills that you need to know, everything from blueprint reading to a little bit of 3D design and fabrication, building jigs. You build, the one center that we visited outside Stuttgart has you build the little, they call it like a robot arm. It's not, you know, there's nothing mechatronic about it. It's just a little arm that you can move around with your hand. But in order to do that, you are piecing together sort of all of these different sheet metal components and figuring out how are you going to cut them? How are you going to machine them?
You're playing with tolerances and fabrication processes. And yeah, yes, like kind of one of those things.
Exactly.
You need all those things to
do. And so, yeah, there's also a metallurgy specification, like a metallurgy track as well. But the majority of, and I've only visited a couple of factories. I'll have more to say in February after I go visit some more German factories. But most people have this Construction Mechaniker apprenticeship, which, and so, right, if you think of the difference, an American kid is going to go to high school for 4 years, and there's sort of the vocational high school and there's the normal high school, but both of those will only get you a high school degree. Right. In Germany, yeah, so there are three different high schools. You can go to the one that's sort of tracked to the trades specifically, which is 2 years. And then there are other options, which are 2 to 4 years. The most sort of advanced is based on if you want more of a white collar job. And so that'll be a 4-year degree program. And that almost always sends you to university. And then the middle one, you can kind of go either way. And there's a little bit of flexibility, but it's, you know, imagine deciding at the age of, what are you, 15, right? What is my career track going to be? And it's, yeah, it's a pretty stark difference. But the thing that works well is you walk into your average German factory. These are places, visited one firm that's the premier, which is the one they make like hot dogs and fish smoking machines. Right. Or one makes specialty construction equipment. Then there are a lot of fab shops which service everything from aerospace to medical devices. And then, of course, there's tons of automotive in particularly in southwestern Germany. And again, this does sort of depend on where you are in Germany. But you walk into, in like the manufacturing center in Baden-Württemberg, the Southwest, you walk into any smaller, medium manufacturer, and every single person on the shop floor has this vocational degree that is combined schooling and apprenticeship. And so they talk about the qualifications to have a job. It's, you know that you have all of these skills coming in, and about 72% of German apprentices are going to stay at that firm where they do their apprenticeship. So they'll also learn all of these job specific skills, and firms will compete to get the best apprentices. And so we had, there were two firms that told us they were bringing in new technology because they wanted to get the most enthusiastic young welders who knew that the future would be something around robots. So they wanted to have robots. And you go to the websites of these German firms and they'll say right here, like, we're looking for apprentices. You click the apprenticeship thing. And it's like, this is our robot. Here's our fancy CNC machine. You will be learning from the best and the brightest. Our firm is awesome. Here are all the social activities we do, et cetera. And so there's a real culture and enthusiasm around having the apprentices in a way where, like, I've visited a number of American factories that will have apprentices or co-ops. But there's nothing that's institutionalized in the same way.
No, and so much of it is whether it's actuality or just, it seems like so many factories are trying to invest so they can not put as much into the workforce, so they can decrease their labor costs or go for people who aren't as educated. It feels like a very different paradigm.
Yeah. Yeah, there's been, at the same time as Germany has been sort of building up its apprenticeship more, bringing, they have a whole, I don't know if you've heard of Industry 4.0, but there's a whole effort to digitize manufacturing and bring in sort of sensors and robots and AI to whatever extent, cyber physical systems, all these fancy words that they're, it's less buzzwords in Germany in the same way that it is in the States, where they're actually trying to bring digitization into the apprenticeship courses. And so they'll be teaching kids when they first get to these vocational schools that, right, where they'll spend half of their time in school and they'll spend half of their time at the factory doing their apprenticeship. It's really trying to introduce them to whatever the new technologies are and get them excited about the future of manufacturing.
Right on. I feel like I had a nice experience with my education and going through the 4-year apprenticeship at Chrysler. It was technically, it was 8,000. Yeah, it is. And that's why I get people who ask me how to get to where I'm going. And there's no easy answer because I can't tell them to do what I did because to be quite frank, I mean, obviously I took advantage of the chances I had and I worked my butt off, but I really got lucky with a lot of things. And, it's not, you can't just be like, go join this union and get into this apprenticeship. And part of it is the unions are so hodgepodge here and they've controlled the apprenticeships for so long. And it's like, you kind of have to have one or the other, like you have to have this really strong labor union where it kind of is overarching over everything. But here it's more like, we've got our little group of people. We want to protect this little thing we have. And it's very localized. It's very niche. I wouldn't trade my education for the world, but I feel like not a lot of people here are getting that education.
Mm-hmm. The phrase that fancy academics will use talking about countries like Germany is co-determination, meaning that like the unions representing the workers and the small and medium firms and the big firms have all been working together since the late 1890s or so to figure out what's the best way to establish these kinds of programs that will let sort of the firms and the workers work together to establish. It was like all of these artisanal programs initially.
It's a circle of benefit. It's beneficial to everyone. Whereas we're just, it seems like we just keep trying to get over on each other over here. Like it's how can we take advantage of this situation for you know, extra money in my bank account. And that goes for whatever level, but clearly the people who already have that money are the ones who are able to dictate the strongest terms. So, it's frustrating. We'll get into that.
There's a sad story from the early days of apprenticeships in metal fabrication, like 1920s-ish in Massachusetts, where a couple of firms realized, oh, hey, we can get poor kids for really cheap. And so the apprenticeship systems were set up with decent intentions.
Right.
But the firms very quickly were trying to force kids to stay, to, you know, work all of the crappy jobs, to stay really long hours, and they weren't really teaching them anything. So, mm-hmm. of course, all these kids left, and it sort of set up the apprenticeship as an exploitative system. Whereas in Germany, there's more of this understanding where kids will go into the factory. Of course, they're going to be not paid as well, but they're also going to be mentored and they're going to be offered a pretty great job upon graduating.
Right.
In a way where a kid in who's that same age coming out of, say, a four-year high school, is not going to have that firm-specific experience.
Right.
I feel like there's many areas of the American manufacturing world that still kind of get, you know, they're still perceived that way in some regards.
And there's pros and cons. Like,
yeah.
There's something to be said for, I'm not a huge fan of our educational system just because it's, and it's not like, it could work, but basic, like our high school system has degraded so much that by the time you're going to university, they're teaching you things that you should have already learned because we're trying to do mass education, so it's catered to like the lowest common denominator kind of thing. But at the same time, having the freedom to be able to choose what you want to do later in life is it's hard to give up. But what are we really giving up when we're going into, you know, six-figure debt by the time we're 22 and we realize even at 18, that's not, I didn't want to do that. I don't know why I did that. And I think in Europe in general I don't have a lot of firsthand, just things that I've read. The European unions have always been strong and it feels like they've always done more on-the-job training, which to me makes a lot more sense, you basically just described that, like the benefits of that. I don't know. It feels like, is it possible for us to change here? Or is that just one of those freedoms where we're like, no, that's my right to not choose to do something until I
get screwed over by college debt.
Yeah. I don't know. I shouldn't say that it's not changeable because I've seen so many things change in the last 15 years. 20 years since I was college age and how we've perceived things. And we were even just talking to somebody the other day about how more and more corporations are, especially in the tech industry, are like, screw that piece of paper, that degree. We want to see if you can do the work. We want to see if you're trainable. And do you see things in our country evolving or changing to be more like that? Or is that kind of a pipe dream?
I think there are parts of it that we can take and that, like, I've interviewed a number of small factories who say, you know, the government sucks. We're all libertarians. The schools around us suck. We want to create our own welding school. And so the number of factories who have people who are the lead volunteered to be the lead for their AWS chapter. And they're going to the local Voke and telling them, look, these are the things that, you know, we small businesses really want. I know more about the system in Ohio, but there's a number of these both employer and worker driven organizations that are work. Whereas in Germany, it's this very formalized kind of government and big firm led system. There's a lot more of this ground up, you know, American innovation style that I think has a lot of hope for the future. As long as we can work on networking that, and I think we do need some degree of government support for all of this, because as you're all saying, there are things that are very broken about our system. And the interesting thing is the German system Actually, last year they had the least, it was a record in the fewest number of kids going on to apprentices. And so even Germany is having this crisis of, you know, maybe kids actually want to go to college. And there's a lot more. And of course, colleges are, you know, either free or heavily subsidized throughout right. a lot of Europe in a way that they're not in the States. But I think it's interesting because they're kind of forces on both sides, yeah. right? You've got the Germans moving away from the apprentices while the Americans are realizing there's the state of, I think it's North Carolina, that has all these German-run automotive manufacturers who are saying we need to set up an apprenticeship system in our state. And so it's German companies working with the state to set up an apprenticeship program.
Oh, that's cool.
And so you're sort of starting to see on both sides. And then I think the boot camp idea that's become really popular, you mentioned programming, that there's a lot of, well, you know, I talked to one firm which had a kid, 20-year-old girl, went to a welding metallurgy boot camp in Maine and came back after 9 months. And she was starting to program this collaborative robot because she didn't have the welding chops yet. But the robot, and this, you know, gets into my interest in the technology, the robot knows how to do those job-specific skills, right? The robot can weld aluminum. And so if all she needs to do is tack the parts up in the right way, she can start getting familiarized with what the welding looks like. And the robot can do the hard stuff while she's sort of working her way up to become better.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was jumping all over.
No, that's okay.
I'm absolutely following you. I'm just thinking through, you know, what that could look like, you know, and I can see it varying, you know, state by state. Quick question about Germany. So this opportunity to go to, you know, go through this high school program, is that pretty much, it's all across the board in Germany? So like, no matter where you live, or is, you know, where you live, does that sort of determine your opportunities very much like it does here in the United States?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, Germany was divided, half communist and Soviet, right? You have Eastern and Western Germany. In formerly Eastern Germany, places like the Ruhr Valley, there was a lot of manufacturing historically, and there still is today, and they do not have these same dense networks. And so you will see sort of vast regional differences. I should mention that I wanted to start comparison. So I went to like the absolute best part of Germany.
Yeah.
That was named sort of at the, it's ironic because thinking of Germany and the southwestern Germany in Baden-Württemberg and the Midwest in the States were both these huge automotive manufacturing centers. And then at the same time in the 80s, as the Rust Belt became a popular term, the state of Baden-Württemberg in Germany had this huge high-tech push for manufacturing and for strengthening sort of state partnerships with bigger firms and smaller firms and the apprenticeship programs. And Baden-Württemberg was named the showpiece land for all of Europe, right? And so these are two regions that really looked pretty similar if you go back to, say, the 60s.
But they kind of...
Yeah, completely diverged. And a lot of that, I think Americans are always a little scared to talk about industrial policy because it sounds sort of like a Soviet centralized planning thing, which never worked in Germany either, right?
Right.
But the idea of... We do a lot of... You think about how much... support we have for military manufacturing or something like we subsidize corn, right? We have massive agricultural subsidies for corn and the corn eating cows then go on to make meat and dairy much cheaper. Like, why don't we have similar sorts of subsidies or similar sorts of policies that really support where there are market failures in manufacturing? And that's something that Germany has done a good job at, like, while still being a thriving and somewhat innovative. The U.S., we really win on all the innovation measures. So that's sort of one benefit to our crazy, everyone can do whatever they want system is we're good at innovation. But as we talked about earlier, if you're going to innovate, you still need people to build that stuff. And those people need to be really good and really clever about building in order to be innovative about whatever hasn't been made before.
That was one of my frustrations when, particularly in, during the global financial crisis in the late 2000s, people were given, the bailout was one thing or another, but the biggest thing is we're trying to compete on a global stage where other countries are very open about their subsidization. Like in Japan, when they developed the Prius, like the Japanese government paid for a lot of that. And then when the United States fell behind in EVs or in hybrids, people are looking at the individual organization, companies saying, you guys dropped the ball. It's like, well, yeah, but their government's helping them with that stuff. But we see that as these payouts. But if you have a global economy, at some point you have to kind of compete with global standards. And I think one of the things that the U.S. is really bad at is calling some things subsidies and stuff. Like, they, just like the terminology and how they hide some things and not others. Like, the idea that, I mean, we corn, like we subsidize so much farming. And I understand the importance of a lot of that. But then the Latin, like, there's a lot of things, there's a lot of issues that that causes too. Whereas there's a lot of, it feels like there's a divide between privatization, like what we think is privatization and what is actually privatization. And like even in a higher education, we look at it as like, well, you should be paying your own way and this and that. And who's getting, the colleges are getting, the endowments are getting insane. The people running the schools are getting, they're the ones benefiting from this, where it should be really the students that are benefiting from it. And we look at everything like where the money's going, the money trail. And I don't think we see the reality of where the cost benefit is compared to a system where there's a lot more put into the other end of the education. The education and just the technology development and things like that. That was a long rambling. Yeah. I don't know if that made any sense whatsoever, but.
I totally agree. I think you look at, lasers. Lasers are everywhere now, right? Yeah. And we Americans developed laser technologies using some grants around the time of the space race. One of the biggest pushes for laser technologies was, the giant space laser that would shoot down Russian nuclear missiles. Total failure of a giant death ray project, but we funded.
How cool would have that been?
Laser technology. It would have been really cool. It's true. Yeah, I'm sure we're still working on it.
I bet we have it, and it's the big non-laser agenda is shutting it down. So somewhere there's a death ray.
The Air Force UFO.
Yes, it was probably. I was at Area 52 working the last couple of months, and it was probably out there. I would not be surprised.
Oh, yeah, that must have been fun.
Yeah, it was. Super it was. Cool. Definitely I was definitely not doing any alien autopsies. Reverse engineering UFOs. Okay.
Let's talk a little bit about the differences in pay. And I'm sure when the German students, German apprentices start out, I'm sure it's still a lower wage. But what has your research shown in America? We see the most drastic difference in wages since the 70s have not increased.
Like 1979.
Yeah.
The change in economic policy and the labor strength was a big part of it. But since 1975, like we're just the middle class continues to shrink and into nothingness, basically.
Yeah.
It's awful.
And so what were you seeing in that same time period in Germany? What has happened? Have they seen an increase in wages? What does that look like?
Yeah, again, this is a story of Germany doing better, but starting to look a little more like the U.S.
Okay.
More recently. And so the, let's see, I just pulled up the numbers. So in manufacturing, looking at this is 2016, and like, I don't even have any idea what's going on with wages right now between inflation and there's
the just last a lot few years have been hectic.
Yes, right. But going back to 2016, so the average German manufacturing worker who has more both general and firm specific skills than the average U.S. manufacturing worker earned $43.10 plus $8.88 in benefits per hour. And the average American earned $39 with only $3.66 in benefits. So you can see they're like closer in the average salary. The Germans have much higher benefits. And then if you look at medium skill, there's a much bigger difference. It's medium skill. That's someone with a vocational certificate in Germany and probably a high school degree in the U.S. And so it's about like the same number roughly of years of schooling, right? But again, the German system is going to be much more tailored towards whatever you're going to go into.
Right.
In 2016, average German earned $24.31 per hour. The average American earned $14.55 per hour. Right. So there's a $10 per hour difference, which means a lot when you're talking about 14 an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That's a huge schism there.
So,
So it's the skill level, right? Because you look at the average manufacturer, the average manufacturing worker is probably knows a bit more about programming or even has a university degree, right? In Germany and the US, because I think there are a lot of, I don't know exactly how they define manufacturing worker, but I think like your automotive company managers would probably count as that. And so it's really this medium skill. And so you look at the US compared to a bunch of comparable developed countries, we are really bad at paying medium skill workers. And I don't really like this term because some of these medium skill, right? It's all about formal education.
Yeah.
It just falls into that classification. I get it. One of the other things that I'm guessing, like here, so let's say you've spent 10 to 15 years in a job. If you go, like a lot of times what will have happen is we'll have people being laid off to hire in cheaper labor, even though it's not as skilled. And then a lot of places, if you top out like roughly in the US, if you're in the skilled trades, 10 to 15 years, you're not going to be making a lot more money than you're making right now. But if you have to start over, a lot of places only pay by seniority, not on skill level. So you're basically like where I work right now, if I were to go in and hire in right now, I would make roughly $16 less an hour than what I'm at right now. And that has nothing to do with skill. It has everything to do with seniority. But I'm guessing in Germany, there's a little bit more loyalty on both ends from both the employee and the employer. There's more of a mutual beneficial kind of thing going on.
Yeah, it really does cut both ways. As you're saying, because the worker needs to know, if I stick around here, what am I going to get for
right.
it? And the firm knows we've trained you up. You know, if you stick around, we're going to make your life better too.
Here, that training is considered a reason for loyalty. It has nothing to do with pay. It's like, well, we trained you, so you should stay here. It's like, well, yeah, you trained me, so you should pay me more, so I'll stay here. Like, there's just this little piece of the puzzle that's missing that kind of affects everything.
Yeah, definitely. And it helps that training is subsidized in the German system.
Totally. Well, and that's another thing is a lot of companies will try to say, like, when there are a lot of people that push for the government to do more, to subsidize more training, which I'm not against. The problem I have is when the companies are pushing for it and then they're using it as a benefit, like that's part of your pay sort of thing. Like that's almost the general gist. It's like, well, you're benefiting because you're getting this training, but we're benefiting because we're getting you really cheap because the government trained you how to do this. Like there's, and it's goes hand in hand with what you were saying, the kind of from the top down. So companies and the government, they're working together. Whereas here, there's always this give and take. There's this push and pull kind of thing going on. Everyone's trying to get over on each other. And that's my biggest issue right now that I have with large manufacturers that are pushing for this is it seems like they're pushing for it not to get better workers, but to get more workers, like more fish in the barrel so that they, you know, they basically more fish in the pond, you can pay less. It's like a competition for lower, you know, people to take lower wages.
Yeah, absolutely. There's economists like to say you can't say that there's a labor shortage unless you can prove that the pay is going up.
Yes. EPI has a, there's a couple people at EPI that had a, it's a definition I use all the time. You know, some people look at me like, that's just some definition that somebody made. Well, it makes sense. Like the having, saying there's a skills gap when you, with no quantification of where the pay is at is you're only telling a third of the story or a part of the story. But I agree with that definition. I think that it's like, there's a certain percentage, like, there has to be a certain unemployment rate and a certain wage increase. And then you can say, okay, your wage went up this much and you're still not finding workers. Then you have a skills gap. And we don't have that. Well, there's like, oh, hi, April. Our little pit bull just
burst
in.
Our dog just walked in.
I looked at, there was like 20 different trades I was looking at, and I think one of them qualified. And it was just by like the slimmest of margins. The rest of them are flat out like even with welding, we look at it as a growth industry. But the reality is the, you know, the Board of Labor Statistics or the Bureau of Labor Statistics is like the growth is average at best. Like it's not this like, you know, this torrent of, you know, and that's where I come in. That's where I feel frustrated when I see all these societies and these organizations putting out that, you know, we're going to need 400,000 welders next year. It's like, we have like 400,000 welders total in the country right now. We don't need, next year we're not all going to suddenly need like 10 million more welders or whatever the numbers they come up with are. So that's, I get frustrated with that. But I'm going on a side note now. So rein me in, Darla. Ooh.
Rein you in, huh?
I'm not getting involved in that. one of the problems, I think, to be fair to particularly the smaller manufacturers, the big guys have no excuse, right? They should just be paying people more.
Yeah.
This goes back to there's a funny history of American firms adopting more technology than the technology is actually capable of in an attempt to get rid of skilled workers. And so you saw this with the automotive firms. They brought in these milling machines around the cusp of when CNCs were just being invented, which were billed as management run machines. And so you could just, the ads say you could just sit at your desk and then have an unskilled operator loading and unloading this thing. And of course it was a total disaster because management didn't know how to program the machines and they got the punch cards wrong. And then there was no one on the shop floor who knew what to do with them. But this all came about at the same time as this real strife between the automotive unions and the factories themselves. And so there's even Elon Musk.
I was just going to say,
the other day,
I was just biding my time until I could, when in Fremont, he was like, I'm just going to automate everything. And it's like,
the alien juggernaut of fully automated lights out factories.
Maybe you don't know more about manufacturing than anyone else in the world, Elon, because that did not work. The exact same thing, like trying to push the technology to do things that it wasn't capable of doing just because you wanted to pay less people.
Exactly. We're really good at that in America.
Yes.
There are firms that we asked about welding robots who would say, oh, no, we see these welding robots on used equipment websites all the time because everyone just keeps trying to buy welding robots to get rid of welders. And then it turns out welders, you know, you even still need welders to program most of your welding robots.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work. And so there are a couple of firms who are like, we're never going to get a welding robot. We see way too many people trying to sell them because they bring them in to replace skilled workers. And then they don't do what anyone wants them to do.
Yeah. And it goes both ways. Like you need both. Like you can't have one. Like, I mean, you can have a welder without the robot, but I'm seeing a lot, and that was one of the things going to FabTech this year that was that personally, like, I was blown away by the amount of automation that was there, but specifically the cobot, the interactive man and machine kind of thing. That seems to be really the next step, and companies are making a concerted effort to make it so that, because just to do, it's the same thing with like the, one of the reasons going from like cruise control or like cruise control or lane control with cars, like going from that to fully automated, that's a huge jump. And it's the same thing with manufacturing, like to go from someone making stuff by hand to just punching a button and a machine to do it, like that's a gap that's just, it's way off in the distance. It's way farther than people realize. Like going to complete AI but man working with machine is kind of feels like that's where that sweet spot is.
Yeah, I love your sculpture with the dancer and the robot. That's exactly it. There's some economists who tried to come up with what tasks are automatable and therefore how many jobs are going to be automatable in the near future. There have also been some surveys asking people in those jobs how automatable do you think your job is? And there's a huge disconnect between what the experts say and what the actual people who do that job will say. And so I was looking at for welders the other day, which says that the economist said there's a 90% automation risk level, and polling says there's a 59% automation risk at most.
Yeah, that's a big schism.
Yeah. And the other thing is a lot of that, even assuming that the economists are right, which they're totally not, right? Those non-automatable jobs are going to be really highly concentrated in particular types of firms. And these are the firms that already haven't been able to automate for a wide variety of reasons. So it's, you know, the people doing specialty military machinery or one-off. Here's a good example of this is a sheath that goes inside a gas turbine that this one was welded by hand, but will soon be welded by a robot. And this is a huge industrial robot, not even collaborative, doing laser welding. But there'll be a camera that a skilled welder can watch and see whenever something goes off, because this material varies by 5%. From one of these fancy cobalt something or other meshes to the next fancy mesh. If there's a slight difference in material, this thing needs to fit perfectly and seal and keep the gas inside a crazy turbine. And you're going to need someone to know if that part gets slightly off. So this is going to have, you know, a welder coming by, expert welder will come by every couple dozen parts and watch little video feed and make sure things are working out all right. Because they said that maybe the gas, depending on how much gas there is left in the tank for the laser, it may vary by a couple degrees. And a couple degrees is going to be enough, because this precision is going to need to be on, you know, thousandths of an inch.
Tolerances are super tight.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. Is a lot of what things that can be automated, especially critical things, you still need somebody with a skilled eye to oversee those things and make adjustments when necessary or make improvements where possible. But, you know, like you hit at least to this point right now, a machine's not going to look at it and be like, I know I can do this process a little bit more efficiently or a little bit better.
Not at all.
We're a ways away from that. And I think when we get to that point, like I always crack up when people are like, you know, like, we want that much money, we're going to replace, you know, all the burger flippers with computers. And it's like, you think when we get to that point, we're not replacing your architecture job with a computer? Or like when we get to that point, like, they're just gonna be doing everything. And you're all like, you know, lawyers are going to be out. Like, we're all going to be, you know, it's going to be Wall-E, and we're going to be in a spaceship drinking milkshakes all day. So I think it is funny how there's a certain elitism where everyone thinks that what they're doing is like, nobody else can do what I'm doing.
You guys seen the new OpenAI chat GPT?
Yes.
Yeah, it's great. Anyways, I could even just share my screen. We can do one right now.
I've been messing around with, my brother got me into doing like AI art, which I think is super problematic, but it's really fun to play with.
Yes. Both agree on both of those. It's wonderful and problematic.
Oh, well, Darla's trying to sign up for.
Okay. What do we want to say?
You're the expert.
Whose jobs are most susceptible?
I heard somebody, I read somebody on Twitter that said something along the lines of, the AI is really good at forming an answer that it think, or like a structure that people will like to read. So there's a lot of bosses that'll look at it that don't have the technical knowledge. It'll be like, yes, that's perfect. Just because it like has the cadence of what the right answer should sound like.
Mm-hmm.
No,
it's telling me it can't do my knowledge work. It's funny. It goes right to assembly line workers too, which is the perception, because you start looking at this stuff. It's so much easier to, with this type of thing, automate any kind of like the chat bots, right? Those, that was sort of an early version of automation, which frankly sucks for a lot of people, both on the user and the worker side.
Right.
But it's really easy for something like, you know, you need to change your password. You need to cash a check, right? Those, you need to do something that's fairly routine, and is not likely to vary from one of those tasks to the next.
It's been done a million times before, and it's going to be done a million times from now, and it's falls within a certain parameter.
Yeah. Like the, you know, what welding robots did in the 1980s when they were first installed in automotive shops. It's
right.
The boring things that, frankly, humans shouldn't really be doing anyways.
That's one of the coolest things that I think about the cobots is, like, I think the last time we talked, I talked about maybe the future of manufacturing. We start getting into, like, cybernetics and you know, implants and things along those lines. But this can kind of bridge that gap where I know people that have become – they adapt. Like, I have friends, one friend in particular who's a quadriplegic, and he still taught himself how to TIG weld. But if you have a cobot, all of a sudden you've got this full range of movement available to you. You've got an arm that, you know, it's almost like a third hand that you can use that becomes an extension of what you're doing. And that's one of the things that I loved when we were at FabTech and, James was showing us the cobot in Miller's booth, and it was, just like, it can be an extension of you. It doesn't, it's not going to necessarily, at least at, you know, at this point and imminently, it's not replacing you. It's enhancing what you can do. And a lot of that is like, I've had 4 major arm surgeries. So all of a sudden I have something that can take, you know, it's almost like Tony Stark with his, Jarvis, you know, like how the early version in Iron Man 1 was kind of clumsy and banging all over the place, but it was like an extra set of hands for him. And, that is something that's super appealing to me that I think makes a lot of sense in that space. And what I'm afraid of is with, and this is something you might be able to talk to a little bit more about, the difference between cultures is we've become more efficient as a country in manufacturing, but all the benefits of the efficiency have gone upriver. None of it has stayed with the employees. Like, we're still doing the same. We're getting paid what we got paid 40 years ago, even though our output has greatly increased, and the powers that be are like, well, it greatly increased because of all this automation, but we're still doing all of that. I don't know. There seems to be this, like, there's this disconnect between efficiency and compensation, I guess. And that's my fear, is that we're going to become even more efficient, but we're still going to be, you know, fighting for scraps at the table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a big question about the question of who owns the means of production,
right?
That Marx and Engels asked back in the day. And the answer to that, you don't need a... There are also some robot nerds who will talk about the term, like, fully automated luxury communism, where
love that term.
I've not heard that.
So that's basically
machine Marxism.
Karl Marx doesn't get into any details, but that's what he's describing as the outcome, which, of course, you end up with a lot of dictators along the way. And
despots
therefore,
everywhere.
You'll end up with the same types of concentration of capital.
Right.
But there's a lot of interesting enthusiasm and thoughts around like worker cooperatives that are popping up now, especially when you start thinking about more and more automation and productivity increases, or even things like profit sharing. You mentioned this is something that Lincoln Electric has been doing for a long time that they're really proud of. And even some firms that we talk to will say, you know, sure, we'll bring in a robot, but people get worried about it. We already have profit sharing in place. And of course, they're probably being forced to do this because the labor market right now is all of these workers coming out of COVID and realizing, wait, how come the government could pay us more when we were just sitting on our butts all day than my actual job?
Right. And people took that as, well, why are you getting all this money for doing nothing? It's like, well, how can they afford? Like, it just shows that we were getting way underpaid before. Like,
underpaid. Yeah.
Well, you're making more money sitting at home. That says more about the job you had that was paying than it does about the money that you're getting right now to sit at home.
I totally.
And that's one of the things. And I don't know. I mean, I don't necessarily think that capitalism is evil, but it's almost inevitable. When I was out working out in Utah, there was a grocery store out there called Winco, and it was employee owned. Like, I don't know how that exactly worked, but it felt better shopping there. Like it felt better going there, you know, like, you have a vested interest. And I know like here, the big three, when the companies are making money, the employees are getting big profit sharing checks. But that's a union negotiated thing. And that's not widespread in the country. And it feels like if anything was going to change, if anything was going to improve, it would be happening right now. Yet, I don't know if we see that. It seems like right now and this is another, like, I'm not smart enough to synthesize all this, but 5 months ago, we kept, you know, everyone was saying, we don't have enough workers, we can't find anybody to work. And fast forward to today, and it's like another 5,000 people got laid off from this company, and people are—it's this force. And somebody recently even said that, like, our economy is based on people being poor. Like, we need poor people to make this work, and it's really frustrating because right now is the time where it feels like we should be making the biggest push towards ethical economics, and it feels like we're going the other direction.
Yeah. I think there's there's so many challenges with changing. I think I am tentatively optimistic about stuff, having gone to talk to a bunch of manufacturers, because frankly, they can't get good people unless they pay them more.
Right.
And you look at the turnover of workers leaving their firms is 4 times higher in the US for manufacturing than it is in Germany.
Yeah.
If firms can keep people, that really makes sense to their bottom line as well. There's nothing about, like, what is capitalism? It's like free market systems, right? There's nothing about a free market system that diminishes the ability of that free market to negotiate if workers are being paid what they're actually owed. And if, you know, you can say that unions might come in and, you know, disrupt, make people be paid more or whatever. But there is also something very fundamental about economists across the spectrum. Carlo Polanyi is one of the more famous semi-liberal economists who will talk about like this sort of seesaw motion between the market. When the market becomes too powerful, I mean, we see this in the States, firms will start buying Congress people and essentially bribing them through lobbying to do exactly what they want. And this is popular across both Democrats and Republicans, right?
Yep.
You've got everyone sort of falls into the pocket of these really big these big businesses, which end up wielding a lot of power, which is actually destroying the market in a lot of ways. And so there's talk about Polanyi has this sort of seesaw motion where the market starts eating everybody, and then people turn towards, I go, crap, we need the government to come save us. And so he was writing this in the context of the rise of the Nazis in Germany, where his view was following this economic crisis, you ended up having people running towards like a much stronger government system, and really voting in, like favoring this authoritarian view of diminishing free speech and in order to control the market. And so in sort of his view, the sweet spot, it'll just keep swinging back and forth and back and forth.
The pendulum never stops in the middle. Sort of sweet spot. Yeah, the pendulum never stops in the middle. It's always swinging. Exactly. Yeah, I'm not going to go down that. Well, I kind of, it's always interesting to me, like the factors that created Nazi Germany were so like coming out of the First World War and the economics of that, the embarrassment on a world stage. Like there was such a very, it was a perfect storm of craziness that created that. But on another sense, like we saw that coming out of like, look at how creating an industry based on militarization brought us out of economic slumps, and it has such a big impact, and it's so dangerous, but it's like this almost like this salve for the economy, like, well, we should build more tanks and everything is going to be better, and if we don't, then we're at risk, but we're also making more money, so
it's what saved us from the Great Depression.
Exactly.
It was going into World War One.
Yeah and even like coming out of World War II, there was this pent up, because we had used all our resources for the military. Now all of a sudden it's like, wow, we can use rubber and steel, and what kind of crazy shit can we make now? And you had the late 40s, early 50s, early 60s, 50s, early 60s, where you had this crazy age of innovation. Like people were just happy to make stuff. And
yeah,
and that at that point,
incredible manufacturing.
We were at the beginning of higher education wasn't what it is now, and you had all these people coming back with money from the government to spend on college education, and then colleges looked at that almost like, well, now we have, they almost turned into a trap. Where I'm getting off subject. I'm sorry. I totally started.
Like the GI Bill was great.
Yes,
the GI Bill.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. And then after that, I mean, I see this here at MIT, basically we could set tuition at whatever we want, but there ends up being this sort of feedback loop of, oh, everyone's bringing in, you know, a couple more fancy sports coaches and a couple more administrators, and we're going to build this brand new building and it's going to look great from the outside. So it's going to be an architectural marvel, and Harvard down the street is doing the same thing. And so then tuition just keeps rising and rising, and there's this race to the top, which doesn't matter for the top universities because they're sitting on piles of money, which goes towards financial aid. So something like 97% of MIT students are on some portion of financial aid. But that's the extreme minority of universities that are privileged enough to be sitting on these dollar piles. And meanwhile, all of these other universities are like, oh, wait, these guys are bringing in a new sports field or a new architectural marvel. We need to do something like that too. Yeah. And suddenly college, you know, costs $70,000 a year across the board. And if you're not going to one of those minorities of schools that have lots of money put aside, you're going to be going into debt for it. And something that was striking to see, I was looking through the education of welders, brazers, and solderers, according to the BLS.
Yeah.
And the number is 23.4% of welders start college and don't get a degree. And, you know, not that some of the smartest people I know dropped out of college, so no judgment on that. But the fact that more than one in five people in this profession felt like they needed to go to college and then they end up with a whole bunch of debt and no certificate to show for it, right? Is like, why is that the norm across, and it's not just that profession. And this, you know, this isn't going to happen in Germany because you're having, and I don't think that we should have kids decide at 15 in this country, right? That would squash a lot of American innovation. Right. But surely there's some sort of balance where you're saying, look, this is, let's introduce you to these types of professions early on. And the other critical thing is, let's have money put aside to help kids figure out what these jobs look like. And to get skilled. And so you go to these German apprenticeship websites, all these firms are like, oh, you're not going to make a lot of money, but you'll be making, I don't know, it's like $20,000 a year as an apprentice, right? So whereas the equivalent vocational schools in the US will say, oh, you're not going to go into that much debt. It's only $10,000 to $20,000 a year in debt.
And you're going to make a ton of money.
You're going to make a ton of money later on.
Yeah. Right?
Whereas if you have zero money, the question is, are you going to go into debt or are you then in Germany, right? They're all going to be making a little bit of money and then a lot more money, and their career trajectories that are laid out very clearly initially.
Right.
And I don't think you need, I mean, you see this with manufacturers being like, we can't find good welders. It's like, well, as you've been talking about, Josh, let's have good job trajectories so you can get your kids excited about welders and then also have careers that they can follow. Where they can achieve seniority both within their companies, or if they want to switch companies, they'll have something to show for themselves. And how normalized we've made this, oh, everyone should go to college. And then if you drop out on college, shame on you. And that's like one in five welders, or probably I haven't looked at other skilled trades people.
And there's a mental toll too, because you feel like, well, crap, everyone else is doing this and I either couldn't do it, whether it's your mind wasn't in the right place or financially or time wise or whatever. And it's like, well, crap. And there's almost like the scarlet letter. And one of the things that for us is super important, and maybe this is where we can bridge the gap, is trying to get like middle school, specifically middle school kids, and then going into junior high, going into high school, at least acclimated with the types of skilled trades jobs that are out there. So then when you're 12, 13, 14, you can be like, wow, I really dig this. I want to pursue this and concentrate on this. Maybe not like put all my eggs in that basket, but I can at least focus on this. Or on the other end, wow, I really don't like this. I need to focus on something else. I need to focus on this other thing that is not welding or machining. Or, you know, it's just like I come across so many people who are, you know, I don't want to say midlife crisis, but they're like, crap, I didn't even know this other thing was out there that I could do. And on the other hand, I see a lot of people who went into the trades who later on realize, like, I'm really adept at doing this other thing. I really didn't need that college education to do this. I'm going to switch over. Like, for I see a lot of welders becoming chefs because they're so frustrated with the trades and this glass ceiling that you have that they want to do something creative. They want to do something with their hands, but they're like, what can I do? That is kind of reinvigorating. That's just something new that I can make a living at doing. And there isn't this ceiling that I'm going to bump my head on. And I don't know why. And I say chefs just because I know like four or five people who have done that, but it's a lot of different creative careers that people go into. And I don't know, it goes both ways. Like there's people who probably are stuck in a cubicle who wish that they would have been exposed to welding. And then there's a lot of welders who probably wish they would have been exposed to some other type of work early on. We just don't do this. We give this like this blanket bland, you know, everyone has to fit in a round hole, whether you're a square peg or a triangle or whatever. And, you know, at the end of it, when you're 18 or 19, then maybe you can, if you know what you want to do, you can specialize in it. But at that point, it's for some people, it's too early. For some people, it's too late. Like, I wish we could do more, I don't know if bespoke education is the right term, but just like the more we can tailor. And maybe that's somewhere where AI comes in, where, you know, we have maybe instruction can be augmented. And even in my career, like early on, people told me I should start a YouTube channel. And I'm like, no, because I learned the traditional way. So that's how I felt people should learn. And now I see all these, you know, these welders that came up and they got their basic education from online and they're really good at what they do. And maybe the next step is sort of an augmented training, augmented education. And people can fine tune it more for what they want or for what they're interested in. I don't know. I'm just.
Yeah, definitely. I think. Well, you look at where these collaborative robots are being so useful, particularly in American firms, is that those job-specific skills. And so, right, like this kid from Maine, she shows up being a pretty inexperienced welder. She's got 9 months of intensive boot camp. And I think boot camps are also, that's a very American concept of let's have some little modularized crash course introduction to something that you can do at any age. And the software engineering has done this really well. And so I'm excited to see this popping up more, particularly in collaboration with firms who can, you know, start doing apprenticeships, can have, because what the apprenticeship is also is a way to try out this job in a low stakes environment. And so you'll know early on, sort of no skin off the firm's back, not particularly difficult for you if you want to switch because you haven't accepted a full job and there are lots of other apprenticeships around. They become more formalized lately in Germany, but the original idea is let's try something out. I feel like that's something that's much more palatable to Americans than you must decide at the age of 15
right,
which high school you're going into, and then that determines your entire life career path.
I feel like there needs to be like, to get to that point, we have to have enough firms offering that, though, because if it's just scattered here and there, then there's still too much of a, like the company still has too much of a vested interest in you staying in that apprenticeship, and you still have that more like that trapped, like, well, I can't just go do something else because this company is what's offering this, so I'm going to have to stick with this. And so it's like, how do we bridge that gap between they're not being the apprenticeships being super rare and them being ubiquitous. Like it's, you know, how do we get to that point and I guess it's step by step. Yeah. Like it's like anything else, like it's not going to happen all at once.
And what's interesting, which I mean, we've touched on it a little bit in Germany, having these specific, what's the name of the, apprenticeship, the construction mechaniker?
Yeah, construction mechanic.
Yeah, that apprenticeship is so it's more well defined, whereas, you know, across the board where here in the US, it's kind of like each
company,
each organization for itself.
And Wild then, West.
Right, right. I mean, and then you have an organization like the AWS, which has, you know, their certs and different things, but even in Josh's, you know, like him working at General Dynamics, he gets certified in something, but if he goes to another company, you have to get recertified. It doesn't count, which seems almost kind of silly. So where do you acquire transferable, you know, certifications where like I have a degree, which it means the same thing here as it does there, whereas there's no like licensure, there's no
like in Canada, you get your standard. Red seal, or, you know, there's a certain, I've talked with this with a few of my friends in the welding industry, and it's like, how do we get, we need a more standardized, almost legally binding kind of thing. I'm not going to get into my feelings on the AWS at the moment, but they're one organization that, there's no legally binding. There's nothing, saying that, well, and part of the thing is we have, like, for every operation, you need a new welding procedure. So, like, if that's one of the reasons where, like, if I get certified in a certain type of welding, if I go, I might have a 6G pipe welding cert, but if I go to work in an oil field, because it's so critical, a lot of times they're going to have you certify, depending on what it is. You might have to certify every day. You might have to certify just when you show up. But there's no standardization. Like, there's an attempt at standardization, but really all it is kind of a money grab. And it's even as a trade.
Firms, they don't care. Just show up and weld in a straight line. You'll be great.
Yeah.
And if you even, move, you know, TIG.
Even as a millwright, you might get different training in one company, then you're going to get in another company. There's no like sort of this, and we hate governmental overreach, but at the same time, without regulation, it is the Wild West, and and a lot of, you know, as everyone wants to be a libertarian until it comes time to like get, actually get something done the right way. And then it's like, well, why did you do it this way? Well, because I can do it however I want to do it. But in reality, that doesn't really work like that. And we like our individualism, but at the same time, I don't know. It's so like, I have a hard time, and maybe it's a big picture kind of thing. Like it's hard to see how you get somewhere from where you are. And really it's just baby steps. Kind of like how it's gone the opposite direction, how Germany is sort of sliding sort of how we do things. We're trying to slide that way.
Right. Are we going to formalize? Because basically what we're really good at is the informal and the innovative. But in order to get the system to work, it's sort of that pendulum again, right? You have everything free market, and it turns out there are a couple market failures. How are you going to patch up those gaps? So
we have all these different standards. Like we have ASME, yeah. We have AWS, we have MilSpec, we have, you know, all these different, and then industries like to think that they know best, or that how they do something is how it should be done. So they create their own set of standards. And
different from, right. I got a new laptop the other year, and this is a USB-C.
Yep.
The reason it's a USB-C is because I'm pretty sure it was the European Union, which said there's too many different types of smartphone chargers out there. Everything must be USB-C going forward. And what happens is companies don't want to make a separate thing for Europe as for US, as for South America or whatever. And so once, I think it took them a really long time to settle on USB-C, but eventually that standard event sort of trickles down. And now, you know, I have an Apple, my lab mate has a PC, we can share this charger for the first time ever.
Which is amazing. It makes so much sense, but it's, and I understand why they didn't do it, but it's like this line between freedom and practicality, really, like economy of scale. I don't know. There's just, again, like companies want to do things a certain way because then they can sell more chargers, or they can sell more of this, or like you're forced into using their product, but it's such a waste. Like it's completely inefficient. It's a waste of resources. It's a waste of money. So like,
right. It's hard, like, for the kids who are now need to get some sort of certification to get a decent job somewhere.
Yeah. And the technology now it's required. Like you have to, it's the same thing with like, trying to get, internet to, you know, poor communities or off the grid areas. And it's like, now this has become a tool. It was this kind of this cool invention, this fringe thing. Now it's so everyone has to have it or you're just going to fall behind. So how do you legislate that sort of thing? It's definitely tricky.
And I think this is the moment for that too, between sort of industrial spending from the government for the first time, may or may not be going into another Cold War, which is always great for innovation in America. But so at the same time, there's this labor crisis and people are realizing, you know, you don't want to work for crappy pay. I'm not sure how long this will continue because at some point people will need jobs. But one of the longer term things that we've done, even starting like 10, 15 years ago, is starting to restrict lower skill immigration. And so we're missing about a million, maybe more immigrants now as compared to the prior couple decades. And particularly folks in Massachusetts will say, oh, we just can't get these cheap immigrants anymore who are willing to work really hard and send their money back to their kids in Laos or Mexico or Eastern Europe or wherever. And so if you want those jobs to be attractive to like the second generation and the kids born in America, we need to improve those jobs, or we need to bring in more low paid immigrants and then figure that system out. But I don't think, you know, hopefully the idea is start creating better jobs because we totally have the technology and the capabilities to do that.
Businesses hate everything. The idea of labor not being a fixed price. Like they look at it year over year, like maybe they want to keep up with inflation. Not always, not usually. But they look at, like, they'll look at every other way to spend money, to save money before they want to put it into, the workforce, basically. And I don't know how you get them to change that. Maybe, I mean, right now is a big part of that. Just like, well, you're not going to get anybody unless you change that.
Yeah.
You would think that the benefit would be.
I think this is what we hope with higher tech jobs too. Like when you start bringing a robot in, you know, maybe this robot's a lot easier to program, but you start bringing in more advanced systems. You'll need people who are more familiar with that, with those systems. And I think particularly for welding, just because there's so many different types and materials and skill levels, I think a lot of this, you know, oh, there's been a welder shortage forever, is that lack of willingness to both train people and keep them around who know the right types of skills. And if you want people to invest in skills that are very niche to that company, right, then if you're talking about, you know, these aerospace welders, they'll do TIG and they'll have to learn. I guess laser welding is now a new technology that's a lot easier to learn, it sounds like. But there are a whole bunch of safety considerations that are going to come with that, that are much more difficult to figure out and make safe than just, you know, protect yourself from the arc flash. And so I think there are a lot of skills that have been ignored, where if we want to really get our manufacturing base up and running, we're going to need to appreciate those a lot more.
Completely agree.
Absolutely. I actually love the wrap up to your Wired article where you say that, but to meet the demands of the future, we need policies that help managers see workers not as costs to be minimized and discarded, but as assets to be strengthened over time. I think it's
perfect.
Yeah, that's exactly it. In a nutshell, our entire conversation.
We just cut everything else out. Nailed it.
But that's really that right there, I think, is, you know, the hope for the future. And it's what's going to keep people excited about these jobs for the future, too, is knowing that you're an asset, not just a budget line.
Just the human equation. Like I always like to say I work to live. I don't live to work, even though I love what I do and I love my work. But you're going to dedicate, and that's another thing that, you know, is neither here nor there. I mean, it is here and there, but how many hours we work in this country and how we feel like it's a token of pride to work. And I do this myself, like, oh, I work 7/12s, I work 100 hours a week, whatever this is. It's not healthy. And even for, it's especially like, it's not healthy when you love doing it. And I love doing it and I'll keep doing it even if it's not healthy. But like, imagine you're stuck in something you don't like doing and you're just working 84 hours a week because you need it to survive or you need it to maintain this level, and the emotional toll it takes to focus. Like when I was at Chrysler, I spent more time with the people that I worked with than I did with my family. I spent almost all my waking time working there, and I loved what I did, but I'd much rather spend that time with my family. And when a company treats you as you're just a serial number, that makes that takes that toll that much higher, because you realize that you're just going there to collect a check and they don't really care anything about what you're doing. And I've seen that so much at my level, whether it's been at Steelcase or Chrysler or General Dynamics, all these big companies. And it's nothing against those companies in particular. It's this corporate mindset that you're replaceable and we can probably replace you for somebody making less money. And we're going to try to do that if possible. And if the union wasn't here, we already would have done it. And just this idea that, like, you, it sounds so cheesy, but it would be so nice if they just cared about the person. And a lot of that comes into, and it's very simple, but pay and benefits is a huge part of that. And if they're not willing to give you, you know, a decent living, then they certainly don't care about any other part of what you're doing. So yeah, I completely agree. There's a social responsibility. There was actually Bill Ford Jr. years ago, and it's kind of like when the automotive industry has downturns, and they have like when I left Chrysler, I took a buyout, and it was fair compensation, and you know, it's union negotiated, but Bill Ford Jr. made a comment one time, and it might have just been for PR, but kind of like who he is, I feel like he has a bigger heart than a lot of people in those industries. Not that I know him, I just like have this feeling. And he said when they talked about Ford workers getting this six-figure buyout, he's like, I didn't fight that at all because I feel like there's a social responsibility, because all of a sudden this community is going to be without these thousands of people with their income earning, excuse me, the community is going to suffer, their families are going to suffer. And then that takes a social toll. And then, you know, there's the economic toll, but I know when I was at Steelcase and they went through this thing where they went from being a family owned company to being a publicly traded company, and they just cut, like, I mean, they did it by seniority, and people with up to 17 to 20 year seniority were just done. And everyone's like, well, they should just learn to do something else. Wow. It's like, they've been doing this job since they were 18. Now they're in their mid 40s and you want them just to learn to do something else. It devastated the community. Like, people were fighting for pizza delivery jobs, and
and you see this across the Midwest and parts of the South too.
Toledo, Cleveland, all those areas in Ohio, you know, Pittsburgh, all these manufacturing hubs have dealt with the same thing. I mean, look at the steel industry in Pennsylvania, or you know, like, they stole their pensions, and people aren't recovering from that. And these towns that were once thriving communities, what was the movie, Into the Fire, or it was Christian Bale and Casey Affleck. And it was basically, this town was just devastated because the mills cut way back, and so people were just fighting each other for jobs, and then literally they turned to crime, and they turned to, you know, fight clubs and things like that, just because there was nothing. And then the drug use escalates. I see a lot of manufacturing workers got caught up because they're literally giving their body, they're giving their health to this industry, and then they break down. And so then you go into these communities, and they're not becoming drug addicts because they just want to do drugs. They're literally, like, their body is breaking down. They need these things. And then all of a sudden that turns into them not having a job, whether it's from that or just the economy collapses. And now you've got situations like you have in Flint, or, you know, these areas that are just completely devastated by the loss of
where
jobs.
They should be having real workers' compensation.
Yeah.
That treats their... Yeah.
And so many, we look at it like, oh, that's a handout, or that's that.
The Sacklers making lots of money on getting people addicted and formulating the most addictive opioids.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And it's, I don't know. Yeah. It feels like there's not a social responsibility in, like, our economy right now is too much based on profits and making more money year over year, as opposed to something that's sustainable, that keeps everyone happy. And it feels like we're so far away from that right now, but I don't know, maybe it's...
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you see this, there's one of my professors was looking at, it's like 80s and 90s policies for urban development, and how it really focuses on the cities that are perceived to be up and coming. So where you think you're going to get the biggest bang for your buck, which it turns out is none of these towns and regions that have lost their manufacturing. It's the places like just outside Silicon Valley. Right. Oh, maybe we can convince some really rich tech companies to move here, or Boston, right? It's not New York City, but there's tons of up and coming, like, massive universities.
Austin, so, Texas.
Right, exactly. And so it's the places that would probably already succeed. And I think we do this in our educational system as well. There's so much more federal money going towards public universities rather than to the trade schools and the 60 to 70% of Americans who don't get four-year degrees. And so there's this idea that let's take the people who are the regions or the individuals who are about to succeed and then really pump all of our resources in there. And then we're going to forget whoever's stuck on the bottom. Or
we sucked everything out of them that we could get. And now it's time to move on to better places.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a challenge, I think, as well with the bigger firms. The customers to a lot of these small and medium factories that I've been visiting, where, you know, if you have 70% of your production going to one big automotive firm and they're saying, oh, either you meet the prices that we're getting in China or we're just going to drop you, right? Then you don't really have the wiggle room as a small manufacturer with 50 or 100 folks. To start paying people better. And so across the board, you end up with this whole depression of wages and of benefits for both the workers and the smaller firms.
Totally.
And so there's, I don't think very much came out of it, but I like the idea of the top Fortune 500 companies got together couple years ago and decided, oh, we can't keep going with this shareholder model. We need to start moving to a stakeholder model. And this meaning the workers and the customers, sustainability concerns, rather than the whoever our wealthy shareholders and executives of our company and, you know, the banks and the venture capitalists who have been funding us, whomever. And so again, it's that kind of pendulum where, okay, we let the free market go wild and now let's rein it back in a little bit and see what bits we can patch up to try and make a better society.
For sure. I don't know how they are now. I know, I think I mentioned this last time we talked that it was the Machine That Changed the World, the book that,
Roos and Womack.
Yeah. And one of the things that one of the things that they talked about was like here when the automotive industry dipped, we all asked the suppliers to take it on the chin. And then they asked their like, so you go from tier one telling tier two to take you down the chin. They tell tier three to suck it or, you know, get better. And whereas in the Japanese system, it was very much a symbiotic relationship with the suppliers. I don't know if that's still the case, but I thought that was interesting when I read that because then, yeah, I mean, and it's
similar to the German model as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And it makes a lot, I mean, to me, it makes more sense from like an ethical, economical system to share. And that's one of the things like I know Ford back in the day, he tried to, you know, sort of like subvert the invisible hand of the economy by making everything himself. But what he found out was when the economy collapsed, he was stuck with everything. So then they tried to spread it all out. But instead of sharing everything, they just, it's down the river. It's down the road. Like, okay, well, we have to make this number. So you're going to make it for this, or we're just not going to buy from you anymore. Just like you were saying, like, it feels like there should be some sort of, in between, I don't know what the solution is, but yeah, I see that all the time, and I feel like that when it's most egregious, like there's definitely some pushback, and then I think some people are smart enough to see that that's not the way to do things. But overall, it's kind of a I don't know, dog eat dog world where we're just pushing the toll down the line to the end where at some point somebody's not going to be able to pay it. And that's their problem, not my problem.
Right. Yeah. And as you're mentioning before, you have China with not just lower wages, but the government is subsidizing robots for pretty much anyone who wants them. And there's subsidies on the material side of getting stuff across China and to port. And so it's actually more expensive for American shippers to get, like in many cases, to get something from, say, the port of Oakland to halfway across the US than it is to get whatever widgets you've got in your shipping container from Shenzhen to California.
And there's not the, I mean, we think that we don't care about the human worker here, like there's a whole nother level of, and I remember, you know, when I was in the automotive industry, we had a, we had a meeting one time, and this guy, you know, one of the executives was talking about the reason we were starting to get engine blocks from, I think it was Brazil instead of Kokomo, was because of the cost. And he's like, and basically he got frustrated. It was like a town hall meeting, and some of the workers were complaining about, you know, losing these jobs and these costs. And he's like, well, if you didn't make this much money, it wouldn't be an issue. And I kind of raised my hand in the back, and I was like, and this is like the whole factory was there, so it was kind of hilarious. But I was like, I've looked at what we, what you were paying for those blocks from Kokomo and what you're paying for those blocks from Brazil, and we could work for free and we're still not competing for that. We're still not competing with their prices because of OSHA, mm-hmm. because of different regulations that we have to abide
by. Material costs.
Yeah. Yeah. Like we couldn't compete based on cost. And he was basically, he's like, meeting's over. And then that was it. Like it's, it was kind of a, like, I felt like a drop the mic moment, but the kind of just got the door slammed on. But yeah, it's, I don't know. Like there's some stuff that, and that comes back to competing on a global economy. Like we're not really competing on a level playing field. And so I don't know. There's a lot of factors that go into it that it's like, what can we control?
Right. Also, the things that we're good at is not low cost mass manufacturing. So,
but to your point, that we still try to compete on that. Whereas in Germany, they, like you, we talked before, they compete on quality.
Mm-hmm. And they compete on making, there's a lot more original equipment manufacturers, which are these small and medium firms, right? The hot dog smoker machine. And I think you, part of the message is probably getting it out to innovators. We come up with new ideas all the time across America. Let's bring the story home that you actually want to, there are firms locally who can make that stuff that we want. And that it, you don't need to go abroad to start having your stuff made.
Yeah.
I think since the, oh, who cares if we're making silicon chips or potato chips back in the 90s, I think there's a real, hopefully starting to get more recognition that actually it does matter a lot. And we can, when we have ideas, we can start having those be made here.
Just as a country as a whole, there's an importance to be able to create things and innovate things and build things yourself. And then you can control the environment that your people, you know, live in, the work in, and you can create a higher level of living for the people with, like, I'm not a nationalist by any means, but I do think that there's something critical about, you know, being able to, you know, build your own stuff. It's important.
And that's how you innovate too. You can't come up with new ideas if you don't know how to build them.
Yeah. And there's
scale if you don't know how to build them at scale.
There was a separation for, as we did this offshoring, this huge offshoring push, there becomes this disconnect between the people. When we look at, did you watch the documentary on the Boeing Supermax disaster?
Oh, no. I followed it closely though.
Oh, it was, I still don't, like, this guy gets paid $70 million to kill 350 people and, you know, lay off thousands of workers, and then he gets paid $68 million or whatever it is to just walk away. That's a whole nother. But one of the things that they consciously did was when Douglas MacArthur? Well, I can't think of when one of the big aircraft manufacturers bought Boeing. They physically separated the engineers from the manufacturing, so they moved engineering from Seattle to Chicago. Couldn't have their hands on the process and slow it down. And I think that, like, that's happened on a larger scale with a lot of our manufacturing, where we're really good at engineering and designing things and then sending it off to, you know, wherever, and it comes back and we have a million of these things come back before we realize, well, we could have fixed this, or we could have made this better, we could have done this better. And I think that's an argument for reshoring, is, you know, just the economics of having something physically, looking at it and being like, okay, that's cool, that works. But there's also the, like you said, to be able to innovate at a pace that matters, you have to be able to make the things, right? You know, where you are. But that documentary, yeah. I can't remember what the name of the documentary is, but it's fascinating.
Oh, I just
it's
found
infuriating
it.
Infuriating, too.
1 mile at a time.
Is that it?
Is that it?
What did you say?
It's 1 mile at a time?
I don't know if that's it or not.
Is that it? I just don't remember the
Let's see here. Oh, no, now I'm getting How to Survive Supermax Prisons. That's not it.
Oh, Downfall, sorry.
Yes.
Downfall.
That's it. Yeah,
I don't know why they called it something else. Yeah.
I know I totally want to go into talking about that, but it's not here or there. You just got to watch it. It's
Speaking of awesome documentaries, American Factory?
Yes. Yep.
Yes.
Watch that. Another one that's infuriating. Yeah.
Oh, gosh. That's the one. Is that the one the Obamas produced?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, the glass plant in Ohio that went from a GM plant to a Chinese-owned plant. And it's really fascinating, like, to see the cultural clashes. But like the one guy who goes to China and basically turns into their like their enforcer, like comes back and is like, I'm ratting everyone out, and But yeah, that's another like that's a community that went from people making, you know, with benefits $35, $40, $50 an hour to now you're making $12 an hour with no benefits. And that community was devastated. And there's a social cost to the things that these companies are doing. And they tend not to want to bear any of that.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. And speaking of benefits, another big difference in Germany is there's subsidized healthcare that's actually good.
That traps me where I'm at. Like with her, we both have medical issues that like she's on one medication that if we had to pay out of pocket, it would be $270,000 a year. Like that's, I can't leave my
Canada.
What's
that? It would probably be affordable in Canada.
It's possible. But I can't leave my job. Like even if I wanted to go out and start my own business, like I can't, I just can't, I can't afford to do that. That's a cost. And then you have all these people like, our system is set up to trap people. I mean, one of the reasons that GM had to be bailed out was because they were the largest private healthcare provider in the world at the time in 2008, 2009 when the collapse happened. So can you imagine if they went bankrupt, all of a sudden you've got, you know, however many people who are, have no health benefits, have no, you know, nothing.
That's insane.
So at that point it was like, well, you know, the kind of the too big to fail moniker, but literally if that would have failed, like everything down the line, like that just, it would have had devastating consequences. And it's all because, and I don't know what the solution is because like government healthcare is kind of sketchy too, but at the same time, like what we're doing right now is not good either. So
it only works for these big firms.
Yeah. Exactly.
And the small firms, so just looking at a survey, like 3/4 of small Ohio manufacturers were saying that they're concerned about rising healthcare costs.
Yeah.
Right. Because suddenly that makes workers much more expensive. And if you go by the saying you want to increase the costs of the things you don't want, right? We want, you know, carbon taxes. You don't want to increase the cost of workers because you want more workers.
Yeah.
And so why is this is essentially an additional tax on workers. And a lot of it, from the little I understand about healthcare, is that we're not, it's not so much a free market as just letting these healthcare providers charge whatever they want for necessary medications.
I remember seeing a,
there's no market. Right, because everyone's got exclusive IP rights, so they can just charge whatever they want, and they have a monopoly on it. And there's no one around to provide competition or tell them that's not okay.
Yeah, there's a great podcast. Oh, what's it called? But it's basically Swindled. Swindled is the name of the podcast, and their dive into Johnson & Johnson is just like, wait, what? They spent how many billions of dollars on lawsuits just so they could like it's they'll freely pay these lawsuits because in between these lawsuits, they're making hundreds of billions of dollars, and it's at the expense of our health, basically. That's another topic, but it's all intertwined. It's a cost.
It is.
It's a cost of doing business. And, I know when I was at Chrysler, and every 4 years, the UAW contract would come up, and management and the media would try to, well, they make this much money because of their benefits. And like, we're the bad people for wanting healthcare and for wanting these things. And, you know, and then the people that don't have those things are hyper jealous of it. So they're like, I don't get it. So you shouldn't deserve it. And it becomes this like, you know, we just keep trying to drag each other down instead of trying to pull each other up. And it's, it can be rather frustrating.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure there are solutions. I don't know enough about healthcare to propose anything.
Right,
but
right.
At least lowering the costs of services.
It's a little outside of my area of expertise as well. So I probably stop talking about it.
But it's again, you know, pitting sort of the smaller businesses and the workers against these big guys who set up the system in their favor.
Very much so.
To the detriment of both American workers and American manufacturing across the board.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I feel like we could talk to Anna forever.
Yeah, we should probably. Probably get dinner or something.
Yeah, I'm imagining that.
I love talking to you.
We could
keep going forever.
This is definitely going to be a two-parter.
I appreciate your support so much because it's really easy to talk inside of this kind of this, not, it's not even really an echo chamber, but it's this little niche area. And it meant the world to me that you reached out, and I was like, okay, I'm not just talking into the wind, and this is making sense to somebody. Like it's not just all in my head, which I was pretty sure it wasn't. But at some point you're like, well, everyone's telling you're an idiot. Maybe you are. I don't know. So it's definitely, definitely much appreciated on my end.
Yeah, because we've been, you know, my professors have been saying this since the, you know, at least the early 80s, that you can't talk about a skill shortage if you're not paying people enough. And there are clearly a lot of problems that just aren't, I mean, finally, I think now we're starting to see some discussions post-COVID.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's so cool to see this, and I'm a big fan of both your work and the Fabricator in general.
Thank you
so
much.
It's a great source for like what the industry is thinking about and what the debates are actually on the ground.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We're so high up. We're just, you know, hanging out here with our really fancy robots, which won't be put into production for another couple decades.
It's still super cool that you're like boots on the ground, getting into factories, like talking to people, and not just in the US, but across the world. That's a really unique perspective that not a lot of people have. And that's super cool. I really appreciate what you do and seeing that kind of work.
It's fun to have our worlds collide. Yeah.
This has been fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure this won't be our last conversation with you. And we're definitely going to make sure that all of our audience is aware of your work and your research. And we're going to have lots of links to articles and the work that you're putting out.
And anytime you need a sounding board or anything, feel free to reach out. Absolutely.
Yeah, I would love to. Thanks. Can chat about my welding education paper
for sure.
Yeah,
that would be awesome. Make sure I'm not just totally running off into the weeds somewhere.
Well, you see that a lot. You see people who write on things, but they never want to get their, you know, hands dirty, so to speak. And then when they put something out, it's like, in theory, that sounds really good, but in reality, that's not really what's happening. So it's really cool to see people who are interested in the actuality of things that are happening.
Anna, have you done any welding?
I have done a little bit of welding.
You should come do a welding workshop.
I was going to say, if you are in the Detroit area, or like if you go to like Toledo or something, we're only about 40 minutes from Toledo. So,
oh, awesome.
Yeah, it would be a lot of fun to have you come up and we'll throw on some hoods and do some welding. I mean, we don't have any crazy laser welders or anything, but...
All right. Those are apparently really easy to use anyways. So.
I used one. Yeah. This year. Yeah. But last year at FabTech, I tried out the laser welder. It was actually kind of weird, but it was cool. It's cool that technology exists. And I'm sure we'll see some really cool, you know, new innovations and things come out of that. But anyways, we would love to host you in our welding shop.
So. Definitely.
Yeah.
And likewise, if you're ever in the Boston area.
We need to make that trip for sure.
So. Oh, fantastic. Yeah, let me know. I'll show you around the robot labs and stuff.
Oh, yeah. That would be amazing.
Hey, we have a guest room.
awesome.
Really?
Yeah, the bed's a little small for two people, but it's
whatever.
It's not infeasible.
We slept in a really small bed awkwardly before.
Last year we stayed in Roswell in a missile silo, and so we were each in separate beds because they were like these really tiny beds.
We had to Lucy and Desi the thing. It was just like two really small beds on opposite sides of the room.
But we were in Roswell in a missile silo, so that kind of made up for everything else.
With all the aliens, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
It was pretty awesome. Yeah, they were the Atlas F, Cold War era missile silo. Were defunct the moment that they were functional and completely defunct, and the government spent $30 million on them and then sold them to the public for $1,700 a piece. So yeah. Nice. Yeah, but it was pretty wild, sleeping where a massive nuclear warhead once was housed. So all right. Well, awesome. Thank you so much for your time giving us a couple hours tonight, Anna. I really appreciate it.
Take care, darling. Thanks, Josh.
Bye. Okay.
Thanks for listening to this special edition episode of Playing with Fire, originally posted on thefabricator.com. We'd love for you to go to the YouTube page for The Fabricator and give it a like or share or add any comments or questions. We love it when you are a part of the conversation too. Thanks so much for listening.